You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is August 1st, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Welcome to August, everybody.
Welcome.
Yay. August 1st.
It's a good month.
Goodbye, July.
Good
month. It's my second favorite month.
Really? August? I don't know. Well, it's just so hot and humid. I'm not an August fan.
That's where my garden's at its most productive.
Ooh. See that? See?
All right. Okay. Fair enough. You know, today marks an interesting anniversary, August 4th, 1921. Can you guys guess what was sent for the first time on August 4th, 1921?
Television transmission.
No.
No, it was like in the 40s.
Ham radio.
Nope.
The transatlantic line for...
Not the telegraph.
Telegraph.
Nope.
The first spam email.
Oh, that's the closest sentence of all of these, actually, Bob. Because cool. On August 4th, 1921, the first fax was sent.
Oh, I was going to say that.
Can you believe that? Yeah.
What's a fax?
Yeah, a lot of people in our audience probably don't know what a fax is, but for a while that was the best way to receive spam, was through the fax. And yeah, technically I think they called it a balinograph, or at least balinograph was the name of the invention, which transmitted the facsimile, invented by Edward Balin. So it was a written message sent from the managing editor of the New York Times, which was scanned and sent by radio from Annapolis, Maryland.
Scanned how?
Got me.
Wait, with the
trying to imagine 1921 technology. I mean, what?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they didn't have a scanner, but I guess, okay, they had, it was a light beam reflected onto a photocell that converted the variations in the received intensity to electrical signals, which were then forwarded by radio or telephone wires.
Cool. Ah, that sounds pretty modern. Wow.
Using a rotating cylinder, I should say.
Ah, well, there you go. There's the antiquity for you.
Was there a squirrel rotating the cylinder?
Exactly.
And actually, at the time that that was sent, I guess that was the first transatlantic fax, because the same method was already in use within Europe for sending photographs, apparently. Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy.
Wow. In the 20s.
Mm-hmm. Facsimiles.
So why did it take so long? Why did we not have faxing back then?
Well, there was faxing. It just wasn't something that everybody had in their home. It became inexpensive in the 70s and 80s. I'm still alarmed when people ask me to fax something. It's bizarre.
We still use a fax quite extensively at work.
Mm. Yeah. For like medical records and
stuff?
Yeah,
you need to send documents around. Yeah.
Yeah. Accountants use fax machines all the time too.
All right. Well, Evan, tell us about this new study looking, using superstition in order to make stock trades.
Yeah. This is very interesting. A grad student from London's Royal College of Art has created a superstitions fund. Now, you've all heard of stock funds, right? Equity funds, mutual funds. Those are sets of investments in various stocks on a stock market. And there are lots of different kinds of funds. They're different in the types of stocks that they carry, or the size of the companies they invest in, or the level of risk involved, conservative versus aggressive. And there are various blends of these styles. So there's lots of different ways for people to invest their money in funds. But the Superstition Fund was designed to manage sets of stocks to make trades depending on several superstitions that are prevalent in society. For example, the Superstition Fund will trade a certain way on Friday the 13th, or it will adjust its patterns on days in which there will be a full moon. And aspects of numerology have been incorporated into the trading equations. So the grad student's name is Xing Ta Chung, and he developed the autonomous superstition algorithm that is actually making these trades for the fund. It's a computer that controls the entire experiment, right? So there's no, he created the program, the algorithms, and the computer is taken over from this point. Participants, investors, were asked to contribute a minimum of £2 each or more, and the investment is tied up in the fund for 365 days, so it's going to be a year-long experiment. The fund is investing in the United Kingdom's FTSE 100 Index, also known as the FTSE, and there's about £4,800 total in the fund, which is now closed. It's been running for the last 2 months or so, so we're already into it. And during that time, the program has been and will make trades purely based on superstitious beliefs.
So it's like every other trading algorithm.
You know, it's interesting. You know, you kind of equate this to, you know, hanging up the stock report from the newspaper on the wall, putting on a blindfold and throwing darts at the stocks you want to choose and, you know, coming up with that as your fund and then trying that out and testing it against some other funds that are out there and seeing what your results are. So, yeah, there's, you know, there's some a lot of randomness to this that may yield some, you know, success.
Well, Evan, that exact experiment has been running for the last 20 years or so, since 1988, actually. What you just described, throwing darts at the stock listings and comparing that to experts, you know, hand-picking stocks.
Right, and there's little difference.
I read a very long article about it, actually, before the show. It's of course, it's complicated. You know, there's no easy answer. Let me see if I could summarize it for you very quickly. So the dartboard method produced results that were similar in many ways to the expert-picked stocks, but it depends on how you ask the question. The pros beat the dartboard 61% of the time. But that means the dartboard beat the pros 39% of the time. However, if you compared the pros to the Dow Jones Industrial Average, they did 51% compared to 49%. So they beat it by just 2%. Very, very slim. It's like essentially random guessing. However, the pros averaged 10.8% versus 4.5% for the darts and 6.8% for the Dow Jones. So in terms of how much money they would have made, they actually did significantly better. So depending on how you look at it, it could seem as if the pros actually do better than average. However, that data has been analyzed by other economists and experts and said, actually, they're not doing better than random guessing because there's a few effects in play here that can explain the difference. One is that people, because the picks that the pros were making were made public. And so there was a publication effect that people were following the pros, which bumps the stock. So if you factor that out of the equation, that eliminates a lot of their advantage. There also was a little bump after the pros made their decision, but before they were published. So, you know, the suspicion is that was being communicated to some people somehow, and that they were basing their trades on the stocks that the pros picked. Also, the pros do certain things which kind of game the system a little bit. One that I thought was interesting was that they tended to pick stocks that paid low dividends. So what that means is that more of the profit of the company went into bumping the value of the stock rather than being paid to the stock owners as dividends. So that artificially made the stocks seem to do better. But they were earning lower dividends on average than the dartboard or the Dow Jones.
You know, that experiment is also like one done just a couple of years ago by our friend Richard Wiseman. Yeah. He gave £5,000 to, or at least stakes of £5,000,
right.
Could have been fake, I don't know, one went to a professional stock analyst, one to an astrologer, and one to a 5-year-old girl. And they had a year, and after a year, they found that the professional analyst picks went down 46%, the astrologers went down 6.2%, and the 5-year-old girl came out ahead, growth of 5.8%.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same experiment, just random choices essentially versus pros. But this is a larger data set because it's been going on.
Yeah. It's just that this is cuter because
that's cuter. It's got a little girl.
It involves a little girl.
Yeah.
Little
so girl. Remember we discussed this issue before that, the stock market is an efficient destroyer of information. And so when the market is behaving efficiently, in other words, no one's cheating, for example, then you shouldn't be able to do better than just following, you know, the Dow Jones average, for example. You should do as well as the stock market's doing in general. If you're doing significantly better than that, you're probably just lucky. Again, assuming that you're not doing something like insider trading, right? Because if you could consistently outperform the market, then what does that mean? That means you're getting access to...
You've got an edge.
Yeah, you've got an edge somehow.
Something that someone else doesn't.
But whatever information you're using to get that edge, because if it's public, then everyone should have access to that information, and there should be enough people who know how to act on it that they essentially destroy the utility of that information as soon as it comes out. So that's what I mean by the market destroys information. So you need to be getting that information quicker or whatever. People always think that they have the magic insight into the market, but no one really has been able to demonstrate that they do. They're just using the successful past predictions to say, oh, look, whatever system I was using must be correct because I previously was, made good picks. But that's just like, astrologers making lots of predictions, and then you think the astrologer who made the good predictions is real. No, it's just that you throw enough darts at the board, one's going to hit, and it doesn't predict who's going to do well in the future. So, that's why I kind of made the joke about, so it's no different than any stock, algorithms, because there is no magical algorithm that gets around an efficient market that destroys information.
But the idea itself of a superstitions fund is a very interesting idea,
yeah.
I thought, because it kind of shows people, well, as the creator of the algorithm says, Chung says that the idea was conceived when he was researching superstitions and case studies about how these irrationalists come to affect the world we live in, right? He says that as a society, examples are often hidden, or we choose to ignore them because we consider ourselves very rational and scientific beings. But at the same time, he's raising questions about our irrationalities and technology at the same time, and he chose the topic of finance to kind of express it with this particular project. He says, we become more superstitious in times of instability, searching for patterns to give us the illusion of control. So with both economic and political instabilities, we're becoming more superstitious, and I think he's hit that right on the head.
Yeah. All right, well, Bob, tell us about the Curiosity.
Well, guys, August 5th, 10:31 p.m. Pacific time is do or die time. The Mars Science Lab, otherwise known as the Curiosity rover, will either burn up in the atmosphere, land safely on Mars, or crash spectacularly on the surface, creating what I'm sure will be called Curiosity Crater. It's really an incredible mission on so many fronts. It's NASA's biggest, most ambitious, and expensive mission yet. It costs $2.5 billion American dollars.
Whoa.
And that's $1 billion over budget, which surprised the hell out of me. I mean, that's a hell of a cost overrun, isn't it? I mean, don't people usually lose their jobs when they miscalculate that much? This is such an ambitious project, though, often requires, ambitious technology to carry it out. And this mission is no different. You know, as cool as what Curiosity can do on Mars, and that includes things like finding the precursors of life, I'm maybe most excited about the landing itself. NASA describes it as 7 minutes of terror, but I call it 7 minutes of cool tech.
Yeah, but your job isn't on the line.
Describe the landing, Bob. What's it going to look like?
I'll get to that, man. I got to build up to that. I'm not just going to jump right in.
Yeah, Bob's going to waste a lot of time first, Jay.
Okay.
Before he gets to the interesting bit.
All right. So I think it's important to say, well, why do we even need new technology? I mean, haven't we done this stuff over and over and over? And well, yes and no. When this capsule hits the atmosphere on August 5th, it's going to be traveling at 13,000 miles per hour. And to put that into perspective, Evan, I thought you might like this. That's 5.8 octillion yoctometers per second. So that's pretty fast.
Oh, I love
pretty
it.
Fast.
You're exactly right.
Right.
Loving that.
That solidified it in my head. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Octometers.
So to land, though, this rover's going to need to be going about 1.5 miles per hour. So you got to go from 13,000 miles an hour to 1.5. So
how's that going to slow down?
You got to slow this thing down. So, well, the next thing I thought, Jay, was, well, how did other missions do this? I mean, we've done stuff like this before. I mean, look at Viking and Mars. Phoenix landers, they use retro rockets, to slowly lower the payload all the way to the surface.
I love retro rockets, don't you?
I know, aren't they cool? Kind of, it's
old fashioned.
It's got that classic image from the 50s of a rocket landing on another planet. And, the thing is, we can't do it. We can't do it for this mission. It's Curiosity is just too damn big and heavy. It's 2,000 pounds, a ton. It's like a car. This retro rockets would not for this job because they would be so powerful, they would kick up they would kick up so much dirt and rock and debris that it would actually damage the rover. So it's not a good idea. They couldn't even think about doing that. Plus also with, these retro rockets would make little craters themselves on Mars, and Curiosity would have to, kind of avoid them as it was rolling around trying to get to the areas it wanted to examine. And then another minor point is that you'd have this, if you have a retro rocket, the Curiosity rover would be on this exit ramp thing, and it would have to go down and to exit the ramp. And that's kind of, that could be a little tricky too. If that thing tips over, it's probably in bad shape. So, some of you guys might be thinking, well, what about airbags, right? Didn't the Pathfinder and the Spirit and Opportunity, they used airbags, and those airbags solved all the problems that I just mentioned. But again, Curiosity is just too damn big. If you had to make an airbag that could cushion Curiosity, it would be so heavy and so expensive, and you know how expensive it is to launch stuff off the Earth. And even with a good airbag, though, you'd have to slow it down so much that you may as well just cut it out of the loop. You wouldn't even need the airbag because it would be going so slow that you wouldn't even need it. So now we have the Sky Crane, and this is the big, cool new bit of technology. It's kind of like a jetpack-like flying platform, and it's a critical technology. Huh. It's really critical, and this will be one of the key components for that last bit of deceleration that's required to get Curiosity on the ground. But there's lots of critical components, obviously. It's a multi-stage deceleration process, and if any one of these components fails, there's going to be a new crater on Mars on August 5th. So here's how we hope it's going
to
go.
That's one hell of a build-up, Bob. Get to it, bitch.
All right. All right. So the capsule enters the atmosphere at 13,000 miles an hour, and the Martian atmosphere is a big pain in the ass.
How fast is that in kilometers?
it's about 100 times thinner than Earth's atmosphere, but it's not thin enough to ignore, and it's not thick enough to slow the capsule like we could do it on Earth. So we need this awesome heat shield, and this heat shield is going to take the brunt of the abuse that this thin atmosphere is going to dish out, and it's going to slow things down to 1,000 miles an hour. So from 13,000 to 1,000 miles an hour. But of course, you've got to pay the price for all the friction, right? This thing is going to be glowing at like 3,800 degrees. Or possibly 1600 degrees, depending on what damn website you're reading. Next up is the biggest and strongest supersonic parachute that's ever been used on another planet. It's a 60 foot wide parachute with 160 cables coming down supporting it. And this thing's got to deal with about 32 tons of force when it starts slowing down the capsule. And when the parachute's job is done, it's going to be going 200 miles an hour. So we've gone from 13,000 to 1,000 to 200. So now it's time for the Sky Crane. The Sky Crane's got the Curiosity rover in its belly. And what's going to happen is that the Sky Crane's going to detach from the parachute. And the first thing it's going to do, it's going to fire its rockets, obviously. But then it's got to skitter to the left or the right because it doesn't want to hit the parachute, right? Because that parachute's still right above it, and it's on a collision course, so it's got to get out of the way. So it gets out of the way, and then what it does, it's pretty much just eating up the last little bit of downward velocity. And at about 60 feet above the ground, it's going to lower the rover about 20 feet down below it. Okay, and then once it's fully extended, then the Sky Crane is going to start descending to the good spot on the ground that it's detected. And then once it has confirmation that the Curiosity's wheels have touched down, then the cables are going to explosively detach, and the Sky Crane, of course, can't stay there. It's going to fly away to a safe distance, and it's going to pretty much just crash on the ground. And that's pretty much the end of the story. But I kind of wish, though, when I was reading this, I wish it could land safely somewhere so that, because I'd love to see it when I visit Mars someday. It'd be cool to walk over to that Sky Crane and say, hey, yeah, there's a Sky Crane I was talking about 50 years ago.
Mars someday.
So, Bob,
you're always the optimist.
Right. To understand this better, the Sky Crane is actually going to stop in midair and lower the payload onto the ground.
At 1.5 miles an hour.
It won't be a full stop. I mean, it'll be going up under 2 miles an hour when it lowers and the rover and the rover hits the ground. So it's going to hit. That's close enough. That's damn slow. Yeah. But man, I can't wait. I really hope they don't screw it up, because imagine, this is such a complicated process. I mean, if one little component fails, then game over, back to the drawing board. And it's,
You think the Mars weather will cooperate? I mean,
well, that's
have a dust storm.
Actually, you're absolutely right. That actually is something that they're afraid of, because who knows? That's unpredictable. Who, you know, you could have some huge gust of wind on Mars, and that could wreak havoc if it's a worst case scenario. Absolutely. So that you got to cross your fingers a little bit on that. Even if we do everything perfectly, you know, Mother Nature is not going to necessarily cooperate. So cross your fingers, even though that won't help.
Well, if all goes well, maybe we'll talk next week about a little bit more about what the Curiosity is going to do itself.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, let's move on. I want to talk briefly about a vocal minority of people who oppose a public health measure that has been shown to be safe and effective, and they oppose it largely with false controversy, pseudoscience, and distortion of the evidence. You may be thinking that I'm talking about the anti-vaccine movement, and I am.
Yep.
But because they do share those qualities, but there's actually an anti-fluoridation movement that is very similar in a
How's
lot
that
of ways.
Still happening?
I know, right? What is going on?
It's been
on
around
with that?
Forever.
It's crazy.
Yeah, because, you know, it's the violation of our precious bodily fluids. It gets people upset.
I had never even heard of it until I saw that movie. And
Dr.
Like,
Strangelove?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's a thing? Seriously?
It was a real scare.
It must have been a thing in the 60s, you know.
After everything we've experienced throughout the years, I mean, you can't even question, like, how strange things are anymore. Like, they deny everything.
It's just that seeing it in the context of a comedy, you know, it was a Poe. I couldn't tell if it was serious or not. It really could have been made up, you know.
That is at the fringe end of the anti-fluoridationists, the ones who think that it's a government conspiracy adding fluoride to the water is to make mindless slaves of us all. But the mainstream, if you will, anti-fluoridation activists just think that their main point is that it's a violation of our freedom to impose essentially medication on the public at large without their consent. The reason we're talking about this week is because there has been a press release sent out by the NYS Coalition opposed to fluoridation. And the press release is discussing the results of a study that was conducted at Harvard. The headline of the press release is Harvard study finds fluoride lowers IQ, published in Federal Government's Journal.
That can't be good.
Da, da, da.
Yeah, so they talk about, again, it's just a propaganda piece against, you know, fluoridation, talking about the fact that there's substantial evidence of developmental neurotoxicity. And Bieber, the guy who is the president of the organization, says, it's senseless to keep subjecting our children to this ongoing fluoridation experiment to satisfy the political agenda of special interest groups. What special interest group
who
is
are
that?
Special, who
Big
is
fluoride.
Specifically and specially interested
Big fluoride.
Big, Big
fluoride.
Dental.
Big dental.
The dentist should be against fluoridation because it reduces their business.
True. Big sugar.
Big sugar. Yeah.
I like that.
Here's the nub of it. For a little bit of background, fluoride's been added to some municipal or local community water supplies since around 1950. It was recognized in the 1940s that fluoride played a role in the health of bones and teeth. And then there was the Grand Rapids study where they added fluoride to one community's water supply and not the other. And then after a few years, study ran for several years, the community getting the fluoride had a 50% decrease in tooth decay and cavities. Since then, fluoride has been added to water in many communities in the U.S., the UK and Australia, not so much in the rest of Europe. So we have about 50 years of research showing that adding fluoride is safe and that it significantly reduces tooth decay, even above and beyond brushing, above and beyond getting fluoride in toothpaste. It's very, very cost effective. It saves estimated $3.8 billion in the US. The Harvard study was actually not a study and was not looking at water fluoridation. It was a review of previous research, and it was looking at the potential for toxicity from fluoride. But the studies that they looked at, most of these studies were done in China. One was done in Iran. They were looking at exposure to fluoride from sources other than deliberate fluoridation of the water supply.
Like if somebody's trying to poison someone with fluoride?
No. First of all, fluoride is naturally occurring in water to various degrees. What our treatment plants do is they adjust the level of the fluoride. If it's too high, they bring it down. If it's too low, they bring it up. The optimal dose is about between 0.5 and 1 part per million, or 0.5 and 1 milligram per liter. At that level, there is almost no risk from the fluoride, and it does significantly reduce tooth decay. However, in the EPA has set a limit of 4 parts per million for fluoride. So if there's naturally occurring fluoride in the water that's above that level, then you know, you would actually remove it to get it below safety limit. So in China, there are communities that have naturally high levels of fluoride in the water. But also, fluoride could be an industrial contaminant. Two of the studies actually were looking at exposure to fluoride from burning coal. So this was inhaled as a contaminant of coal burning. And the levels, so here's the, now the key is that what the researchers did was they looked at studies that compared different levels of exposure to fluoride. The high exposure group had typically between 5 and 10 parts per million of fluoride, although again, some had much higher, but that was sort of where most of the studies fell. And the low fluoride exposure group had between 0.5 and 1 parts per million. And they showed that the children who were in the high fluoride group had, on average, the studies have showed a lot of variation in terms of how much of a drop in IQ they had, but it was about 0.45 standard deviations, or like 7 IQ points. So here's the thing. The low fluoride group, the group that had the higher IQ in these studies, had the same exposure as the recommendations for fluoridation in the public water supply. The people who had the children who had the lower IQ had levels of exposure that were higher than the EPA limits for safe levels of fluoride. And yet this review was used by the anti-fluoridationists to argue that fluoride is dangerous. So it actually showed the opposite of what they're claiming. They just distorted it, cherry-picked statements from the study, didn't really explain what it was. It wasn't even a study of deliberate fluoridation of water supplies. Just to say, look, fluoride's a toxin. You should be scared. Yeah, everything is a friggin' toxin. Everything's a toxin at a high enough dose. It's all about the dose. At the doses that we're adding to water, these studies actually showed was safe. That was the group that did better.
So it goes to show you, it doesn't matter even what the research says. They just put out a press release and say what they want, and the actual research results are meaningless.
Exactly. I suspect that half the time they don't even read past the headlines. Ooh, look, a scary headline. Let's use that in a press release. Now, even worse was that because they sent this out as a press release, I know we've discussed this many times before, that a lot of online news outlets were reprinting it under their news tab as news. Sometimes with the disclaimer saying that this has not been subjected to editorial review, sometimes without, but it creates the false impression, especially for the unwary, that this is like an actual science news item. And that's how it came to my attention. Numerous people sent this to me as a news item because somebody was posting it on Facebook. You know, it was being propagated through the social media.
Yeah, I can't blame local governments when they read things like this and they get scared and they don't understand. I mean, they don't know the research. They don't understand the history. They don't understand why people would lie about it and everything. So sure. And people are typically fall prey to this stuff from things like this. And that's why blogging is useful and important. It's also important for people to go to these meetings or local government meetings and educate the people that are there and don't let crazy stuff like this pass. That's something that you can do with a few hours during a weeknight at the right meeting at the right time and make a difference in your local government.
Yeah, it is a situation where information is actually helpful, just spreading the correct information. Well, let's move on. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about the bat-winged monkey bird.
Yeah, you heard right. The bat-winged monkey bird.
It it's exists. Epic. I want one.
It's a noted phenomenon. We have some eyewitness accounts. Well, we have three eyewitness accounts. They're all from the same person. They're three individual accounts, and they were all separate incidents. Two did occur while she was very young, 4 years old.
Well, 4 and 11.
Yeah. It's credible. Okay. So there's a zoologist, a cryptozoologist. He's both. Dr. Carl Shuker. He has a blog and he got in touch with a woman who claimed to have seen a bat-winged monkey bird in England. She's from Kent and she described seeing this thing three different times. The first time she was 4 years old and traveling back from her auntie's house in London, she says, driving up to Kent, going through the countryside.
And she was watching The Wizard of Oz. Is that it?
Possibly. Well, no, this was 1969. When was Wizard of Oz?
39.
Tough to say. 4 years old. Who knows? But I can tell you that she says that her dad had been driving for a half an hour and that it was dusk. She said she looked out the back window of the car, looked into the trees, and she saw a monster with bat wings that it unfolded and stretched out before folding back up again, red eyes and a kind of monster monkey face with a parrot's beak, and it was about 3 feet in height.
She's remembering this from
That's
4 years old.
A lot of animals all
4 years
in
old.
One.
Yes. So that was the first incident.
I saw a ton of monsters when I was 4 years old. A ton.
Yeah. And did you see them again?
Yeah, all right.
So this
like
is
that.
Where it gets. Okay.
Did you see them
so,
again?
So yeah, when she was 11, again in the car on the way home from Hastings, she saw it again out the back window of the car. She says that that was late at night. And then the third time was just last year she saw it. She says it was 4:30 in the morning. I was awoken by the same horrible screeching sound. It made a screeching sound, by the way. Thinking someone was being murdered in the street, I jumped out of bed and ran to the window, catching the tail end of it as it flew past. I knew immediately what it was. The same horrible monster thing I had seen all those years ago. The bat-winged monkey bird was back.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so she had a four-year-old fantasy of this bat-winged monkey bird, maybe provoked by a memory. Who even knows? So then she had this image of the bat-winged monkey bird in her brain. So on other occasions when she saw some fleeting tale of something, she happily filled in the details with her pre-created fantasy.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so for starters, you don't remember things from when you're four. You remember memories of memories of memories of things when you're four. And pretty much they're all wrong. Everything you remember from when you were 4 years old is wrong. It didn't happen.
Even if it feels completely right? Even if you think it feels like it's a real memory.
No matter how real it seems, it's wrong. Especially if the memory involves a bat-winged monkey bird. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, both of the sightings from when she was little, she says she was traveling in a car at night. The first one when she was four, she says it was twilight. The second time when she was 11, she says late one night. I don't know about you guys, but when I was a little kid, I used to fall asleep in the car all the time.
Oh,
yeah, it's relaxing. You know, you're on a long drive.
Half asleep.
Both of those were, you know, long drives. So yeah, of course, you know, there's a chance that she was awake though, you know, especially when she was four, glancing out the window at trees flying past in the car. Of course, a four-year-old's going to fill in blanks and have all sorts of interesting imaginative fantasies. But the chance that she was actually dreaming increases greatly once you realize that it was at night, it was in the car, she was very young. And then the last time, as an adult, when she sees it, 4:30 in the morning, she wakes up and sees this thing. I mean, that sounds exactly like a hypnagogic hallucination.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, it's not out of the question, but it is kind of fun to imagine that maybe there is some ultimate argument ender of the bird versus monkey debate. The bat-winged monkey bird is here to join all our factions together in one terrifying nightmare visage.
They did a report on the Mongolian death worm, so I don't know.
The Mongolian death worms are really interesting, little known cryptid. So, yeah, I'm cool with that. Yeah.
I like the Alaskan bollworm better.
The Alaskan, that's new to me.
Yeah.
Deadlier?
It's another SpongeBob reference. Anyway.
You know what? I'm sorry I can't keep up with your highbrow references.
Yeah. Evan, Evan.
Yo.
Who's that noisy?
Yep. Yeah, let's get right to it.
In the end, I succeeded.
Do you know who that
I have
was?
No idea.
Is?
Wink Martindale.
Dr. Professor Sigmund Freud.
Oh.
The only known recording of his voice.
Oh, shit.
Wow, cool.
Which was recently discovered and made available. He was 81 years old and suffering from jaw cancer when he made that recording. And he was close to the end there. And they said every word was agony to speak for him at that point of his life. So,
all right. So who did get that first?
David Kellogg emailed us with the correct answer first. Sigmund Freud. Well done, David.
Good job.
Good job, man.
And this week.
Okay, here we go. Who's that noisy? All right, clearly that's an instrument being played. Yep. Yes, yes, yes. However, we need to know exactly what instrument.
That's me playing my didgeridoo for the first time.
Jay, we don't need to know about your personal life. So, go ahead, send us your answer. Do a little research, figure it out. I think someone will get it. info@theskepticsguide.org or post on our forums, please, at sguforums.com. Good luck to everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Well, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by Brian Wecht. Brian, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Brian is a theoretical physicist, musician, and comedian. You have held positions at the Center for Theoretical Physics at MIT, the Institute for Advanced Study, and the University of Michigan, but you currently work at Harvard University studying string theory and supersymmetry. So you buy that whole string theory business?
kind of has to.
Well, you know, I buy it as a theoretical thing. I don't actually know. I think this is something that's kind of a generational thing, although some of my colleagues might yell at me for saying this. I think a lot of younger string theorists like myself are interested in string theory as a tool for understanding quantum field theory and particle physics, and not necessarily as a tool for understanding the real world. So I'm kind of agnostic on whether or not we'll ever be able to understand our, you know, four-dimensional universe with the particles that we see from a direct string theoretic point of view. But yeah, I totally buy string theory.
Well, Brian, okay. What's your take on the classic objection to string theory that it's just not testable?
I mean, I think string theory is testable at extremely high energies, although some people might even argue that. But it's certainly not testable in any realistic time frame, if ever in human history. So I think that is dead on, unless we come up with some brilliant, amazing new way of testing it that we haven't thought of yet. But people have been trying very hard for a long ass time, like, you know, 30 years to come up with a way of testing string theory even indirectly. And so far, no dice.
I think Michio Kaku would disagree.
We can talk about Michio Kaku.
Shall we? We got to decide.
Brian,
guys,
can you quickly just explain what string theory is, if there's even a way to do that quickly?
Yeah. The quick way of doing it is just to say that, so string theory posits that, you know, we normally think of particles in the universe as being these, what I would call zero-dimensional things. They're just little perfect space-time points. They have no extent. But what string theory says is if you actually really got up on one of those things, if you could really, really look at it at very small distance scales, you wouldn't see a point, but you'd see a little vibrating one-dimensional object, a little line or a little loop of string. So essentially, that's the whole idea behind string theory, is that when you really look at a particle, you see a string.
But is it, like, are you saying, is the inherent question here, is it a wave, is it a particle, is it both? Like, are you seeing it in it, because it's moving, it looks like that, or it isn't actually physical in the way that we understand what physical means?
I mean, what I would say is that the string is actually the, on small enough distance scales, the correct way of seeing that thing. It has nothing to do whether it's moving or being a wave or anything like that. It actually is a little one-dimensional object.
Well, then, Would it necessarily then be indivisible? And what would it be if it's one dimensional? How could you really have a one dimensional anything? What's it made of?
There's no way of answering this without being a little tautological, but it's made of strings. So there's some sort of thing, this fundamental, like, filament of energy, right, which is stringiness. And that is what a string theory string is. So when we talk about particles in string theory, they're just made of this stringy stuff. And that's as best an answer as I can give. You know, it's like this, the difference between a string theory string and like an ordinary wave on a string is that there's this fundamental stuff that has, well, I guess this is true for waves on strings as well, has some tension to it. So when you pull the string theory string, it's got a little bit of pushback to it. And that's what causes the different vibrational modes.
And those different vibrational modes determine what kind of particle or object it is on the macro scale.
Well, that's sort of true. So the thing with string theory, though, is any vibrational modes we'd see, even the first vibrational mode of the string, is already pretty massive by our normal sort of point of view. So it's additional properties like stuff that comes from how we, you know, string theory has these extra dimensions, how exactly what we do with those extra dimensions that determines what the kinds of particles we get out are. But typically the particles we talk about in the standard model are just like the lowest lying modes of the string.
And the appeal of this is that it makes the math work out. I mean, it's just as it's a conceptual framework for understanding the math of particle physics. Is that what you were saying?
No, I wouldn't say quite that. The real appeal of string theory is that it gives us a way of talking about, yeah, exactly. Giving us a way of talking about gravity and particle physics using, essentially the same language. So the problem with gravity is if you try to talk about gravity using Feynman diagrams, which are the, you know, language of particle physics, whenever you do gravity calculations, you get essentially, infinite answers. So that's bad, right? There's some infinities you can get rid of in particle physics. These are infinities you can't get rid of. And the thing about string theory is, it cuts off those infinities and makes them finite. So that's why people really take string theory seriously. Because doing that, it's hard just from what I'm saying to understand, if that's difficult or not. But it turns out to be an amazingly difficult problem and one of the most difficult problems in modern physics.
Is getting rid of the infinities, is that called renormalization? And does string theory fit into that category?
The renormalization is a way of getting rid of infinities in the standard model. So the problem with normal quantum gravity is that it is non-renormalizable. So what string theory does is essentially just makes the theory just objectively finite and not through the kind of renormalization procedure that you'd normally do in particle physics.
Okay.
And is quantum loop gravity the alternate to string theory? Did I get that correct?
Loop quantum gravity.
Loop quantum gravity. That's like an alternate. I learned that on the Big Bang Theory.
These are like the two opposing camps in quantum gravity, and you know, there really is a lot of butting heads between the two. String theorists take their approach very seriously, and kind of, you know, I don't want to be too dismissive in a public forum, but regard the loop quantum gravity guys as maybe not being quite as rigorous, and I think the loop quantum gravity guys probably think the same thing about the string theorists.
Awesome. Can you be both?
I don't know anyone that is. It's, you know, it's kind of like a West Side Story thing. It's very hard to cross that divide. Only one guy I know of who's a string theorist, has actually spent time sort of with the quantum gravity crowd trying to understand what they do. But, you know, part of it.
Up.
Yeah. Oh, he's dead now. Part of it is that, you know, you just have only so much time to focus on your research, and learning an entirely different research area is going to be quite a big hit. So I think the guy that even did this spent like several years with loop people. I don't remember the paper too well, but I remember his conclusions not being super positive about what he thought about loop quantum gravity. But it's a hard thing to go back and forth between the two, and no one really does it.
So when you pass a loop quantum gravity physicist in the hallway, do you like snap your fingers like the Sharks and the Jets?
You just pull out the knives.
You have a choreographed dance that you do whenever you pass.
Awesome.
It's pretty funny, actually, that very few institutions have both string and loop groups. The only one I can think of offhand is the Perimeter Institute in Canada. But I'm sure there are others that I'm just forgetting right now. But it's pretty rare to have universities that have both string theorists and loop theorists. But I think the loop community is actually substantially smaller than the string community anyway.
So, Brian, is this a deal breaker? Like, if you met a loop girl, would you be like, oh, no, and you have to pass on that? Or
well,
what?
Is she hot?
She's hot. Yeah, she's West, damn hot.
That's fine.
You could live with that.
Brian, what about M theory, membrane theory? Do you need string theory in order to get to something like membrane theory, which I think is a very cool theory? Oh,
yeah. People mean a lot of different things by M theory, but what I typically mean when I say M theory is this sort of super theory that includes string theory in a bunch of different sort of corners of, if you like, parameter space. One particular corner of that is an 11-dimensional theory without strings that has membranes. But these all seem to be sort of dual to each other. And when physicists say dual, they just mean they are sort of different ways of describing the same problem. And sometimes one description is easier, sometimes the other one's easier, and you kind of go back and forth between them. But so far, there hasn't been a hell of a lot of understanding of really how to formulate this super theory called M-theory. So that's been a long-standing goal of string theorists. It was in the, I think, 95 that Witten posited this idea of M-theory. But I hate to say there hasn't been a heck of a lot of progress in really coming up with what that big theory is.
Ah, shit.
It's too bad.
Yeah, it's a bummer, and it's one of those things that people who don't like string theory harp on and, you know, might be correct in doing so. They say, look, you guys have had a lot of time to develop this thing, and despite all your big promises, you don't have a lot to show for it. And on that particular question, although there certainly have been insights and has been progress, it's not really where we wanted it to be.
So, Brian, this has been a very fascinating warm-up, but the reason we actually brought you on the show this week is to give us some deeper insight into the alleged discovery of the Higgs boson. We've been talking about this on the show a lot. A couple episodes ago, we announced, we were actually a little bit late to it because we were pre-recording for TAM, but they finally got to the 5 sigma with the Higgs. So we definitely need to talk to a theoretical physicist to help us understand where they are with the research and what the implications of this are.
Well, I think what we can say right now is that they found something. And the big question is, we know it's a boson, but the question that is going to require a lot more data is it the Higgs boson that people have been talking about, you know, for whatever, 50 years now?
What's a boson?
Boson. Great question, Jay. A boson, there are two kinds of particles in the world, bosons and fermions. And roughly speaking, the way, what distinguishes them is this intrinsic quantity called spin. But the way I think it's better to think about them is as things that obey the Pauli exclusion principle, which are fermions, and things that don't. And what the Pauli exclusion principle is that says that, if a particle obeys the Pauli exclusion principle, you can't have more than one of it sort of in the same quantum state. So, for example, the thing that everybody is familiar with here is when you're doing high school chemistry and you're filling out the periodic table, you say, okay, in the 1s orbital, I can put an electron up, and then I can't put another electron up, I can put another electron down, and then there's nowhere else to put electrons, so I have to bump over to the next orbital. And that's because electrons are fermions, and you can't have two electrons be in the 1s spin up or 1s spin down state. You need 1s spin 1, 1s spin down, and then you got to bump over. So a boson is just something that you can that doesn't obey that kind of exclusion, and you can dump as many bosons in the same state as you want. And then you get what's called a Bose-Einstein condensate at low temperatures.
Of course.
Yeah, they're cool.
Got that, Jay? You're good?
I understood about 10% of it, which makes me feel pretty good.
Let me say it.
It's 10% more than you knew before.
Yeah, another way, which is not actually, it's kind of misleading for the Higgs, but another way of saying it, at least in our standard experience so far, is that fermions are matter, like things like electrons and muons and quarks and stuff like that. And all the bosons, except for the Higgs that we know, the bosons mediate forces. So an example of a boson is the photon, which is how things talk to each other through electromagnetism, talk to each other.
Like force carriers, Jay.
Yeah, that's exactly what they are.
Okay.
But the Higgs is not a force carrier. It's a boson, but not a force carrier. And that's why I tried to
do
the Pauli exclusion principle. And I think that's something that is a crucial distinction to make.
All right, so why is this discovery significant? Why do we care?
Because without the standard model of particle physics seems to work like ridiculously well for explaining the universe that we see. So that describes all the particles, the electrons, the muons, the neutrinos, the quarks, all that stuff. And the problem with the standard model is unless you have this extra thing, which is the Higgs, we don't know how to give a mass to any of the elementary particles. So something like the quark masses, if you try to write down a quark mass without a Higgs, you just can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Higgs is important because, and this is not an understatement, like without it, we really don't know how to give a mass to any of the elementary particles in the standard model. And this is why theorists say it's like, it's such an ironclad theoretical prediction that everyone really thought it was there because it just had to be. There's nothing else we know how to do.
Is this the last major puzzle piece to the standard model?
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to say. I mean, there are other There are other puzzles like
dark matter.
Dark matter is not part of the standard.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not the be all end all. There's plenty of stuff that the standard theory does not cover. Dark matter is just one of it. One big puzzle that also needs resolution.
Absolutely.
And gravity as well is another piece.
Yeah, and dark energy, of course, is a big one, right? Why is the universe accelerating, the expansion of the universe accelerating? And in fact, we think dark matter exists is one of the reasons that people are pretty hopeful that the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, might see some other junk that we haven't seen yet. So those of us who are more optimistic hope that the LHC is going to produce maybe whatever is responsible for dark matter. That seems... You know, you can argue about whether that's likely or not. Most people would probably say that's unlikely, but it is certainly a possibility that we're really hoping for.
And the process that the LHC was undergoing in the experiments to find the Higgs, they basically were smashing stuff into each other, like particles, and hoping that like one little squiggly trace that comes out of it is the Higgs. Is that the kind of data they're looking at?
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly right. So they take two proton beams and they smash them into each other. And then the quarks in the protons are made up of three quarks each. Those quarks interact because the protons are moving so quickly and smash into each other so much that they overcome the electrical repulsion. And the quarks can see each other, and then those quarks smash into each other at high energies and spew out a whole mess of particles. And then what the LHC tries to do, and this is how complicated this is, just blows my mind. They try to infer what happened from the few decay products that they can see. So they measure like electrons and muons and photons and other stuff that comes out of these collisions. But trying to get back to what process caused that is just a tremendously difficult task. But that's what these guys are doing, not just every day, but like basically every second of every day with their data. It's an incredible accomplishment.
It sure is. And Steve, they're not going to actually see a squiggle that's the Higgs. I think what they're going to see is, like Brian said, you're going to see the decay particles, the result of something that was probably produced by the Higgs, right?
That's right. That's right. And in fact, the two big channels, and by channels, I mean the way the Higgs decayed, that they noticed at the LHC were Higgs going to Z particles, which then decay into other stuff, and then the Higgs going into two photons. So the Higgs actually does other stuff much more often than that, but the problem is that is completely swamped by all the other stuff that's going on in the standard model. You're not just producing Higgses, you're producing all sorts of other crap, you know, basically every particle you can think of, and the decay products that come out from those are masking all the stuff that any Higgses you're producing are decaying to. So what they needed to do at the LHC was basically collide things together enough that they could pick out these very, very rare Higgs decays and see them.
So why are we still kind of floating around the idea that they didn't 100% prove it? I mean, where are we now?
Well, we're at a state where we have the data is consistent with what we expect from the usual standard model vanilla Higgs boson, but what we need to still do is narrow down. So we're in some region of parameters, and like one point in that whole parameter space is consistent with the standard model Higgs. But to say, hey, this is really the simplest thing we could possibly imagine, we have to keep whittling down all those possible parameters. And the only way to do that is for the LHC to take more and more and more and more data. So people are they're being a little bit hedgy with their statements because they're scientists and they want to be careful. But it is true that the most correct thing we can say right now is that we found something which is consistent with what we expect from the Higgs boson, but it is far too early to say, yeah, this is definitely what we expected. And of course, to people like me who want there to be other stuff beyond the standard model, I work on supersymmetry a lot, for example. What I would love to see is the Higgs having some unexpected thing that then we have to explain however we have to explain it. So that's why people are refusing to just say, yeah, we got the Higgs, because there's still a lot of work to do to figure out exactly where in the parameter space we are. You know, the pessimist in me, it's not really that pessimistic to say all of theoretical particle physics is correct, I guess. But the pessimist in me thinks that we'll probably narrow it down to the standard model Higgs within a couple of years. But no one really knows the answer to that question.
So what you're saying is you hope that that the data shows that the Higgs is not quite what the standard model predicts, that there's some other aspect to it that requires a deeper or another theory to explain, and therefore it'll be a little doorway into some other theoretical framework that will explain things outside of the standard model, like supersymmetry, for example.
That's right. Or maybe not even explain. What it would require is something beyond the standard model to explain why the Higgs is doing whatever weird thing it's
doing.
So there was some like tiny little hint of this in the data they released a few weeks ago in the decays where the Higgs goes to two photons. We saw more of those events than you'd expect from the standard model, but not in what I would call a statistically significant way, in the sense that with more data, that anomaly could just sort of go away. So people are hoping that persists, but it's far from clear that that's going to stay around for even through the end of the year.
But scientists are supposed to hate mysteries.
Yeah. Well, when your career relies on there being mysteries, you like them a little bit.
Yeah.
More. Hey, Brian, it would be really cool if they actually determined that, that the Higgs-like particle that they're seeing is something outside of the standard model. That would be fascinating,
oh,
of course. But my question is, what would that mean for the standard model then? Would that mean that the standard model was incorrect because it didn't predict the correct type of Higgs?
No, it would mean that there's just other stuff out there beyond the standard model. So it looks like the standard model is correct. But what you'd need, for example, if the Higgs decays to two photons more than you'd expect from the standard model. Well, there's maybe just some other particle. Maybe it's a supersymmetry thing. Maybe it's dark matter. Maybe it's something else that is causing those excess decays through its interactions, with the Higgs. So it doesn't mean that the standard model is wrong. It just means there's something else out there that we haven't accounted for yet.
Oh, and if you plug that into the standard model, it would make sense then. It would predict what we did see.
That's the hope. I mean, okay. At the moment, we know, you know, it's optimistic to even be talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
But the idea would be that we just say, oh, actually, there are more particles, and this is how they interact, and now we need to include them in this framework. But the standard model certainly doesn't require extra stuff a priori.
So like a lot of things in science, it would be – the standard model would be correct as far as it goes, just incomplete. Right. I mean, I think a lot of people mm-hmm. get into this false dichotomy of a scientific theory is either right or wrong. It's either 100% correct or it's incorrect. But in fact, once this theory becomes fairly well established, it's the chances of it actually being overturned approach zero. Once we have decades and mountains of data to support it. And the standard model has been ridiculously successful, as you said. But it could be incomplete. There could be other aspects to nature that it just are not accounted for within the model.
And in fact, we know for a fact, basically, it's incomplete because of dark matter, dark energy, all this stuff that we were talking about before.
Yeah.
So the question is it incomplete in a way we're going to have experimental access to or not?
Right.
And that's a big question. You know, if the LHC sees exactly the standard model Higgs and then nothing else, like let's say it runs for 10 years and then it sees no sign of dark matter or no sign of anything else beyond the standard model. At some point, you have to ask the question, do you keep doing particle physics? Because you can't just build bigger and bigger machines forever, especially when you don't have a compelling reason to keep doing it. So, yeah, we know the standard model is incomplete. The question is it incomplete in a way that we're going to be able to study further?
Well, nature's not allowed to exist in a way that we can't study.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. I mean, I think, so far nature has been every time we find something new, there's something interesting just on the horizon.
Yeah.
And we find something else awesome. And then, you know, although this is not really a scientific, statement, it's just a statement that science has continued to be interesting and particle physics has continued to be interesting. So, I think it's reasonable to hope that it continues to be interesting in the future.
Brian, you mentioned supersymmetry a number of times, and that's part of what you study. Can you give us a brief description of what that is?
Yeah. So remember, we were talking about fermions and bosons. So what supersymmetry says is that for every one kind of particle, so for every fermion, you have a particle which is identical, has the same mass, same charge, same everything, except instead of a fermion, it's a boson. Or if you start with a boson instead of a boson, it's a fermion. So for example, if the standard model were supersymmetric, we have this fermion called the electron. We would also have another particle, which is a boson, which is just like the electron, only it has a different spin. So that's the idea behind supersymmetry. And the reason people like supersymmetry, even though, you know, clearly there's no particle that's a boson with the mass of the electron, because we would have seen it by now. But the reason people like supersymmetry is when you add in all these extra particles, you get these kinds of cancellations, which help explain, for example, why the Higgs mass is as light as it is. So supersymmetry gives you these massive cancellations when you're doing these Feynman diagram calculations that help explain why some things aren't as big as you might have naively expected. So that's the basic idea behind supersymmetry. But the problem is that we just haven't seen it.
So to summarize, your whole career is based on stuff that we can't really test and may not be true.
You know it.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Brian, it's really been fascinating having you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, guys. This was a blast.
And guys, don't forget to go to storycollider.org to listen to and sometimes see Brian's podcast.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Brian.
Good night.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. However, this week, Bob is taking over science or fiction.
What?
Absolutely, and I hate this job.
I was uninformed.
Come on.
It's not as easy as it sounds. Number one. Researchers claim evidence of an unknown species of hominid, not from fossils, but from the DNA of hunter-gatherers from Cameroon and Tanzania. Number two, study finds that brain imaging can predict how intelligent you are. And number three, theory shows that ultra-high-energy cosmic rays are likely caused by the collision of three or more supermassive black holes. So, like I said, Rebecca, what do you got?
All right. DNA of hunter-gatherers from Cameroon and Tanzania. Okay. Trying to figure out how that would work. It doesn't come from fossils, but it comes from DNA. So where do they get the DNA?
Well, I should be a little clearer. It's modern-day hunter-gatherers.
Oh, from the DNA of modern-day hunter-gatherers. Oh, yeah. Okay.
People that are alive.
Right now. Okay. Oh, well, that's interesting. I like that. I like that idea. Brain imaging can predict how intelligent you are. Don't like that idea. That triggers all of my skeptic alarm bells, because what is intelligent? Intelligence isn't it's not some quality that's clearly defined that can be seen on a brain scan or anything else. I'm skeptical of that. And even if that one is true, even if there was a study that did find that out, I would be highly skeptical of the study. Third one, theory shows that ultra-high-energy cosmic rays are likely caused by the collision of three or more supermassive black holes. Three or more, that's a lot of black holes colliding. But I suppose it could happen. If they're supermassive, then they would have trouble avoiding each other. So... And once if they do that, then, yeah, I can see them producing ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. Yeah, I'm going to have to go with the intelligence one. I'm so skeptical of everything involving intelligence tests that I have to. I'm saying that one's the fake.
Thank you very much. Evan!
Bob, good one. Good choices this week. I'm very proud of you. Darn, I was hoping to get a read from you by that. All right, but it didn't work.
Oh, you bastard. Should have made you go first.
Next time. Okay. Unknown species of hominid, not from fossils, but from the DNA of hunter-gatherers. I don't see why that couldn't be, which brings us to the brain imaging. Yeah, I think in agreement with Rebecca on this. What is the measure of intelligence, like you said, Rebecca? I think they might have been able to find this a long time ago. I'm not sure that this would even be something recent, unless there's a new imaging procedure that's happening that wasn't available a while ago. But you'd think that this was something that wouldn't be new news. It would be on the older side of things, maybe 5-10 years ago. Last one. Ultra-high-energy cosmic rays are likely caused by the collision of three or more supermassive black... Well, okay, Bob. So there's so many things in here that, you know, just... scream Bob novella that I don't see how this one could possibly be fiction, because it's just too cool not to be fiction. But I'm trying to just give a little thought as to exactly why cosmic rays likely caused by the collision of three or more supermassive black holes. Why three or more? Why not?
Thank you, Evan.
Why not
Jay.
Two?
Oh, wait, sorry.
Okay, well, I agree with Rebecca.
Thank you, Evan.
So which
Jay.
One? What's your pick, Ed?
I say brain imaging predicting intelligence is fiction.
All right. So the first one about the DNA from hunter gatherers, it's interesting. I really can't pick that one apart. Just it is what it is. So I'm going to move on. The second one about the brain imaging can predict how intelligent someone is. There's a lot of things to be said about that. You know, what is intelligence and is there a telltale sign of it in the brain? I don't think we're able to scan the brain that well yet to be able to notice those things. I also think that this one, I could see where Bob twisted this one. Maybe they're saying that at some point they might be able to do it, but maybe not today. And the last one about the ultra-high energy cosmic rays being caused by the collision of three or more supermassive black holes. That's another one, sure. Yeah, I could see that. So I'm going to go with the brain one, not because Evan and Rebecca picked it, but because I simply just don't think the technology is even close to being able to read that.
GWR. Mm-hmm. GWR.
Thank you, Jay. Steve.
Well, the one about the DNA is very interesting. I'm trying to imagine how that could be done. I suspect that those two populations have mutations that are unique to them. The thinking there being that they were reintroduced into those populations from another side branch of hominin that's not around anymore. So I guess I could see how that would work. The one about the brain imaging and intelligence. So all that requires for this one to be true is that somebody did a study where they measured IQ and they looked at some brain imaging and tried to correlate something on the brain imaging with the IQ score. I mean, I agree with Rebecca's skepticism about what the real implications of that data would be, but it's totally believable that somebody did that study. And then the third one is the one I have the problem with, the three black holes colliding. I know, you know, there's still a bit of a controversy, a mystery about what the source of the highest energy gamma rays are, or cosmic rays, and that black holes are thought to be a source of that, maybe colliding black holes, but three or more? I mean, why wouldn't two colliding black holes be enough? What would be special about throwing a third one into the mix? And how often can that really occur? You know, we're three. But, I mean, colliding simultaneously? So, I don't know. I think that one is the one I think Bob probably tweaked. So, I'm going to say the black holes is the fiction.
So, you, Rebecca, Evan, and Jay think that the brain imaging is fiction, and Steve thinks that the supermassive black hole, ultra-high energy cosmic ray one is fiction. So, that means I will start with number one. Researchers claim evidence of an unknown species of hominid, not from fossils, but from the DNA of hunter-gatherers from Cameroon and Tanzania. And that one is science.
Right.
And, yeah, Steve, you pretty much, I knew, that's why I made you go last, because, these, I knew you would, either, I wouldn't be surprised if you read these or just.
I have not read any of them for the record.
Yeah.
When I make you do the science of fiction for me, it's because I don't have enough time to do it myself, so I'm not reading a lot of science news items.
Jay and I are wrong. I guess we'll find out.
Not necessarily. So, scientists studied the genetic blueprints of 15 hunter-gatherers from Africa, and they found DNA evidence of a sister species of sorts that branched off of the hominid tree around the same time that Neanderthals did, about 1.1 million years ago. Now, this line that was created, that was evolving, was isolated from the line that produced us for quite a while. But then, through interbreeding, they got some of their DNA mixed back into the Homo sapien genome, and this is what they found. They found, like Steve said, they found these anomalous bits of DNA that they believe came from another, you know, branch of the hominid tree. Now, I recently read though that there are detractors, of course, and they actually come up with a viable counter argument. They claim that it's possible that the DNA came from a genetically distinct group of modern humans that have since died out, and that seems fairly plausible to me, but regardless, these main group of scientists though believe that they have found evidence in you know extant DNA of another species of hominid that existed hundreds of thousands of years ago that they still survive in a way in our DNA, and if it turns out to be true, that'd be really cool. And so it's especially interesting that they found this not you know digging up bones, but actually just in the DNA of modern humans.
That is really cool.
Yeah. Let's see. Number two, study finds that brain imaging can predict how intelligent you are. Rebecca, Evan, and Jay think this is fiction, and this is science.
Oh, yeah. Nice job, Steve.
Yeah, good
we'll,
job.
We'll see about
crap. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, right.
I'll send you the link. Essentially, that's what they're claiming. This was published in the Journal of Neuroscience, and I'm getting some of these quotes from the medical press website. They said that new research from Washington University in St. Louis suggests that 10% of individual differences in intelligence can be explained by the strength of neural pathways connecting the left prefrontal cortex to the rest of the brain.
Oh, boy. God, imagine you go on a job interview and they want to scan your brain. That's going to be really bad.
Right. The big advance here is that these findings establish this idea of global brain connectivity as a new approach for understanding human intelligence. The article I read didn't go into much detail on exactly, how they assess human intelligence and what kind of tests or whatever, how they characterize it. Let's see.
You know what they call that, Bob?
What?
Like a map of how the brain connects to itself?
No, what?
The connectome.
Oh, awesome. That's great. I never heard that one. Welcome I was trying to think of an ohm word, but I was like, awesome. Lead author Michael Cole, PhD at Washington University. He's a postdoctoral research fellow. He said, which is pretty much just a reiteration of what I've said, our research shows that connectivity with a particular part of the prefrontal cortex can predict how intelligent someone is. And apparently this is the first study to provide compelling evidence that neural connections between the left prefrontal cortex and the rest of the brain make a unique and powerful contribution to the cognitive processing underlying human intelligence. So there it is.
So that's it then.
Yeah.
All such studies are fraught with the limitation of using IQ as a measure of quote unquote intelligence. I mean, it is measuring something. It's just kind of misleading to call it intelligence because, that can refer to so many different things.
Yeah, Bob.
And it does sound plausible that the strength of the neural pathways connecting these two, the prefrontal cortex with the rest of the brain kind of makes sense on the surface that would have a huge impact on intelligence, but it was 10%. It's not like they're going to say, based on this brain image scan, your IQ must be 141.3. No, it's just a 10% difference, but it does let you predict, make some sort of prediction that's better than just rolling the dice, I guess. Which means that number three theory shows that ultra high energy cosmic rays are likely caused by the collision of three or more supermassive black holes is fiction. I pulled that completely out of my butt. I could not find any. I couldn't find any.
And
any
Steve
news
touched it.
I couldn't find any. Oh yeah. Typically, I'll find a real news item, and Steve does this as well, where you find something that's real, and then you just throw in the word not, or just. Could just kind of reverse it, make it the opposite of what it is. And I couldn't find anything and I said, all right, I'll just make something out of whole cloth. And I was like, ultra high energy cosmic rays. They are a big mystery. We have encountered these ultra high energy rays in the past and, we have no idea what produced them. We have some theories. Some of those theories involve black holes, but not colliding black holes. Black holes in the terms of, active galactic nuclei, galaxies that have very active cores. There also is talk of interaction potentially with dark matter, but nothing that had to do really with, no one's really theorizing that, the collisions of black holes, could possibly do this. And I thought it sounded somewhat plausible, and I did kind of scratch my head about, well, should I throw in three or should I just say, just more than one, just two supermassive black holes colliding. And I guess I made the wrong decision because the three, I think, was a bit of a red flag. I was kind of playing into the idea of that it's very rare, and it would indeed be very rare to have three supermassive black holes collide. It seemed plausible. I probably would have bought that if Steve had said that, if he did the science of fiction, but
it's tough, right? But, I mean, it's tough to make, you want to be fair and you want to have a reason to think that something could be the fiction, but you don't want to make it too obvious. And that's a very fine line to walk.
Yeah. But, congratulations, Steve. Great job.
Thank you. You guys could suck it.
suck Bob's black hole.
Nice.
Got it.
Oh God.
Wow. That was a very polite.
That's pretty epic, Steve.
Polite put down. I mean,
that's the way you want to play it. Yeah, yeah, sure.
All right. Well, Jay, give us a quote.
This is a quote by Alan Moore. Anybody remember who Alan Moore is?
Remember him.
Dudley's brother.
That's right, Rebecca. You did meet this guy.
Yeah. We've had long conversations about snake puppet gods.
I said remember because I've quoted this guy before. He's actually a pretty interesting fellow. He's an English writer, and he's primarily known for his work in comic books. The quote is, which was sent in by listener John O. from Germany. Yes, there is a conspiracy. Indeed, there are a great number of conspiracies, all tripping each other up. The main thing that I learned about conspiracy theories is that conspiracy theorists actually believe in the conspiracy because that is more comforting. The truth of the world is that it is chaotic. The truth is that it is not Jewish banking conspiracy or the gray aliens or the 12-foot reptilioids from another dimension that are in control. The truth is far more frightening. No one is in control. The world is rudderless.
Alan Moore! That is spot on. That's sort of the answer to all the big grand conspiracy theories. Nobody has that level of control over what's happening. Crap just happens.
Yep.
There was a slight hiccup last week when the show went live. The tickets for the private recording to CSU at Dragon Con were not on the site, but they are now. As of this recording, at least, there are still some tickets left. So if you go to skepticalrobot.com, you should be able to order your tickets there. They're $50 each, and they are going quickly.
And we have just started a Kickstarter campaign, our first one. This is to support a new web series that we are planning called Ock the Skeptical Caveman. The first episode is up on YouTube, but you can also see it along with our Kickstarter introduction. The link is kind of a long one, so you could search for the SGU or Ock the Skeptical Caveman on Kickstarter, and we will have the link in the show notes. We really need your support for this one. You know, producing videos takes a lot of time and effort, but also a lot of resources. And the more we get, the more we'll be able to do. The more videos we'll be able to produce for you with higher production value. So please consider giving us some support. And I know we talked about our various trips during the TAM show, but I wanted to make sure that we thanked Charlie from Google for hosting us there.
Thanks, Charlie.
Yep, he was super awesome and basically was our chauffeur for 2 days while we toured Google and Pixar. And also thank Chris, Craig, and Donald from Pixar and Sheldon from the Bay Area Skeptics for hosting us and making us feel so welcome when we were over on the West Coast. We actually interviewed Chris from Pixar at TAM, and that interview will be aired in the coming weeks. Fascinating discussion of the technology that goes into producing those little pixels.
Yeah, can't say much about how much fun we had with those guys at Pixar and with Charlie at Google. It was one hell of a side trip that we took, and I hope that we can maybe do it again next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome.
All right, well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Steve. Thank you, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune or your portal of choice.